Hello, and welcome to this podcast from the Oxford Institute for Energy Studies.
Hello, and welcome to this latest in the OIES podcast series. My name's James Henderson, and I'm Director of the Energy Transition Research Initiative at OIES. Today, I'm joined by Mikhail Maidan, who is Director of the Gas Programme and also the China Programme at OIES. We'll be discussing the theme of China, its environmental policies and their relevance to COP26, which was the topic of an article which Mikhail wrote for the latest edition of the Oxford Energy Forum. The forum is entitled COP26, Examining the Balance Between Ambitious Pledges and Realistic Expectations, and it can be downloaded from the OIES website. Mikhail, good morning and welcome to the podcast.
Hi, Jim. It's good to be here.
Great. So, Mikhail, your article is called China's Ambiguous Climate Position, and from reading it, that about sums up not only the current situation, but also the history of the last 20 or 30 years or so, with China's policies and strategies for the environment being, as you say, somewhat ambiguous. As a start, let's go back and have a look at the history of China's environmental diplomacy and perhaps create some background for the current situation.
Absolutely. I mean, I think to summarize it rather succinctly, China's sort of gone from zero to hero and sort of back again. The initially sort of post-Kyoto China, I think, was a bit of a bystander in global climate talks. It didn't see an urgency for itself to be actively involved. The whole issue of committing to greenhouse gas emission reductions was something that China was very reluctant to do, but it was actively involved in the implementation of clean development mechanisms. And really the point was that China is a developing country. This is developed countries' problem and fault, and therefore they should be the ones really leading the way. In the early 2000s, things started to change as concerns about pollution increased in China domestically, and therefore China also started to play a more important role and in pledges to mitigate greenhouse gas emissions, for instance, and that led to a more constructive policy at Copenhagen. But there was a lot of issues on kind of the actual negotiation tactics and the style, with kind of leaders all sitting together, but Premier Wen Jiabao not really rolling up his sleeves and chatting with everyone. And for a number of reasons, China was really seen as a key contributor to actually what was perceived as the failure of Copenhagen. 6 years later, however, in Paris, China emerged as really a leader and of global climate negotiations and a positive contributor after also it had reached a deal with the US, a bilateral deal that really ramped up ambition and gave momentum to the entire process.
And how does this play into the domestic agenda as well? I mean, obviously, we've had the blue skies strategy and concerns over air quality. How does that fit with the sort of the international diplomacy that's been going on as well?
And absolutely. I think the question is spot on because nothing or very little that China does internationally is disconnected from domestic realities. And even though international pressure and sort of image play a part in what China does, really it is the domestic drivers that shape positions and policies. And, you know, in the 1990s and early 2000s, China was focused on growing, on economic development. It was only, and actually it's... economic growth was relatively efficient in terms of energy consumption. It was in the 2000s after China accessed the WTO and economic activity was skyrocketing. Energy use was also increasing extremely rapidly. And in 2007, China was the world's largest emitter, having overtaken the US. Local air quality issues were a big problem. Now, there was still a disconnect between tackling local air pollutants and mitigating sort of carbon emissions, with the latter being slightly lower on the list of priorities. And that was also, again, part of the discussions at Copenhagen. By Paris, however, China's own economic model was changing, sort of economic rebalancing and a shift toward consumption rather than sort of heavy industry, and, you know, a slower economic growth where China's coal demand had peaked. And so this really made it easier for China to commit to peaking carbon emissions around 2030, to having, you know, non-fossil fuels account for a larger share of its energy mix, and therefore for it to take a more positive and proactive position at Paris.
And, I mean, you've mentioned the ambitions increasing. Obviously, we've now had the net zero target by 2060 that's been set. So can we say that China is now taking the kind of 1.5 degree centigrade goal much more seriously? that it really wants to be involved in the negotiations on a much multilateral basis? Or is it still trying to sort of stand apart a little bit?
I think that's a good question. It does still, you know, stand apart in that I think increasingly China's willing to take a leadership role. It has shown in the fact that this time its pledges are not connected to a US-China agreement or to an EU-China agreement, even though the EU would have liked, you know, any announcements and pledges to have been undertaken jointly. So China is contributing to the multilateral process. And, you know, the net zero statement from China has injected a lot of momentum globally, right, with Japan and Korea following suit. And, of course, the US under the Biden administration. So, of course, it does want to be very active in the multilateral forums. But it is also, it signaled very clearly that China will chart its own course and do things in its own time and according to its own domestic constraints. I think on the 1.5 degrees centigrade, China has never really bought into that. It's been talking about 2 degrees and sort of a hope the 1.5 degrees can be achieved, but it is certainly operating right now still on the basis of 2 degrees.
And talking about sort of taking its own path, there would seem to be quite a lot of advantage to China being a leader on environmental issues and pushing the environmental agenda, given that it's, you know, developing green technologies and pushing forward with the manufacturing of, for example, you know, solar panels and wind farms, et cetera, et cetera. So is there a commercial as well as a sort of geopolitical agenda going on here?
I mean, there are definitely a lot of interests that are converging here. And China's sort of dominance in green tech and clean tech, its growing role and its importance in supply chains for new energy materials, those have all positioned it in a way that it can capitalize on, you know, more global ambition towards the energy transition. So certainly there is a business opportunity there that can translate into, you know, a diplomatic stance. Again, I think we will have to see a COP26, the not the theatrics, it's not such a great word, but sort of how things are represented in the Western media again. Because from China's vantage point, it's coming in with very ambitious pledges, right? The 2060 net zero is transformative for the Chinese economy. Yes, there are considerable opportunities, but it will also require a huge amount of, well, change and potentially pain. So China's, from its point of view, is bringing a lot to the table. From an international perspective, it is being opportunistic. It is not giving enough detail on how it plans to get there. 2060 is not fast enough. But there are certainly opportunities here and just concerns that the world has a carbon budget, that the EU is going to introduce carbon border adjustment mechanisms that will take a toll on Chinese exports, and therefore China has to act in order to be compliant in a carbon-conscious world.
And, you know, so talking about that, there are clearly areas where there's going to be debate, one might say dispute, and one of the big ones would appear to be coal. You know, the UK presidency has made a big play of trying to remove coal from the energy system altogether. It's obviously a massive part of China's energy economy. Encouragingly, China's announced that it's going to stop funding overseas coal projects. But what about the domestic coal agenda? That's obviously a huge issue. And of course, has been highlighted, you know, as we speak around power shortages, etc. I mean, how does that whole coal question play into the views on COP26 from China?
I mean, that is one of the key areas of ambiguity, not just for COP26 in China, but really for China's energy policy as well. You know, China has pledged already at the Biden summit in April that it would peak coal, or that, you know, coal would start to peak in the next five-year plan, so in 2025. But it is clearly stated that right now it still needs coal as a reliable source of baseload power. And I think the other thing we have to be a bit careful, the pledge to stop overseas funding of coal, again, is a very welcome pledge, but China's funding of overseas coal has already started to slow. Now, whether that is a COVID sort of, you know, that's due to the impact of COVID or to constraints and pushback from recipient countries is to be seen. But the fact of the matter remains that China's overseas coal financing has slowed. But Chinese involvement and operations in construction of overseas coal mines has not slowed. So, you know, when China talks about stopping overseas funding, does it actually mean that it won't be involved in any coal-fired plants overseas, or that it's just, you know, ending the kind of bankrolling and financing of it? So even that, we have to see the details. within China, I think this debate about coal is very much heightened right now by the power shortages. And there is an argument for China to accelerate its move to renewables, and I think that will happen. But the coal shortages are also due to price distortions and to other issues that, you know, suggest price reforms will come. But on coal itself, I mean, it is still the backbone of the Chinese energy system. It is about using it more efficiently and about dealing with sort of peak demand. But so I think coal is not going away anytime soon, and that will be a challenge at COP26 as well.
There are a couple of other themes for COP26, which, you know, China, I'm sure, has some very important views on. The first is carbon markets. There's going to be a big discussion around Article 6 of the Paris Agreement about, you know, the development of carbon markets and carbon offsets. And obviously we've seen the emergence of a carbon market in China with China's ETS. How do you think China will be, you know, discussing carbon, global carbon markets? You've mentioned CBAM already and the potential for a dispute with the EU. How do you think China sees that whole issue of carbon markets?
I mean, CBAM is clearly a threat and a huge concern for China. It will want to position itself and portray itself again as a leader of the developing world that is opposed to, you know, carbon tariffs that would not just undermine Chinese exports, but could also, you know, reduce the competitiveness of exports from other developing countries. The ETS, you know, you could be a bit cynical and say, you know, China's launch of its emission trading scheme in July this summer, you know, was well-timed just ahead of the publication of Europe's CBAM. And so it was, I think, an attempt to show both the EU and the world that China is doing something on carbon tariffs and carbon prices, but that I guess the EU and the rest of the world need to give China and other countries time to develop these tools. So there's a sort of a defensive mechanism, but I think this will be a hugely contentious issue where China, I think, will be able to rally quite a few other developing countries to say, look, we need more time and we need to discuss this globally and not a unilateral move from the EU. And again, I think this will be a contentious issue at COP26.
The other issue I wanted to talk about was the kind of financing for developing countries. You mentioned in the article that China's positioned itself as a leader of the G77 and has been vociferous on the need for funding in the developing world from the developed world. That seems like quite an interesting position to take given the size of China's economy. So I'd be interested to hear whether, you know, the developing world is happy that China seen as its leader, but also how aggressive do you think China's going to be on this financing issue? Because that does seem to be one of the main potential sticking points at COP26.
Again, I think China's going to try and push for a concrete and very clear commitment. Again, on the ambiguity of things, China has long positioned itself as a developing country and been arguing for common but differentiated responsibilities, even as its economy develops. And it will stand to win, as we just discussed, from any financing. Its industrial capabilities and its export industries will benefit from this. So, but I think the 100 billion or sort of any financing will be one of the kind of key diplomatic stances as, again, China seeks to sort of cement its position as a global leader for the G77 and for the developing economies.
It's interesting that China itself is doing quite a lot of financing around the developing world. I mean, you've mentioned supply chains for raw materials. So how does China see its role in providing finance? And in terms of those supply chains, are they a security of supply risk for everyone else? Is that going to be a kind of topic for discussion, do you think, at COP26? How does that play out in the kind of whole green agenda?
I mean, I would assume that with everything that's going on in energy markets right now and the energy crisis, you know, the affordability of energy and electricity will overshadow talks more than sort of China's control over supply chains. But as the energy transition continues, I think these questions of supply chains and of technological innovation and who leads the kind of technological race will figure prominently, right, for every policymaker and in multilateral decision and in multilateral forums. I mean, China has, in a lot of these areas, it already has a head start in part because this is part of its industrial strategy, right? A few years back already, China identified that, for example, in the auto sector, it won't be able to compete with its Western peers. And really what it needs to do is leapfrog into EVs and into battery technologies. And so it's been laying the groundwork for this for many, many years. So Beijing now has a head start. We've seen from renewables that there are huge benefits to international collaboration, to kind of innovation coming from developed countries, and China then being able to scale up and reduce the cost of technologies. I think today we're in a very different world where that will be much harder politically and geopolitically to sell. Again, that's not necessarily advantageous for the energy transition as a whole.
So given this, I mean, what are your expectations for A, the Chinese position at COP26, and B, what you think China kind of really wants to get out of it and whether they'll be able to? I mean, where do you see that?
I think we're still 1 month out from COP. I think there will still be changes. We're recording this in early October. China has not yet issued its revised NDCs. There is an expectation that China could give a date for peaking carbon emissions before 2030. There's a lot of debate sort of within China and within Chinese think tanks about when that date could be. But it's probably going to be 2028 or 2029. Again, not something that will be overly taxing for China. Historically, what it's done in international forums is issue targets that it can meet and even exceed rather than bind itself into something that will be very difficult to achieve. And there are sort of domestic policy papers. It's sort of one that's called the 1+N, which is the roadmap towards the energy transition that China is expected to release in the next few weeks. So, you know, all of these things China is still going to release and it's going to issue. From China's point of view, it wants to emerge a winner, right? Already it's issued these more ambitious pledges. It's taking on global climate talks and global climate finance. How that will be perceived in the West, I think that will be the challenge for China, and also sort of, you know, very different narratives coming out of COP26, because China's unlikely to pledge to peak emissions by 2050. It's unlikely to take a more aggressive stance on coal. And, you know, even the policy documents, the 1+N and others that China issues for a Western audience are extremely vague and they're full of political jargon. So I don't think that will be enough. China will want recognition. I'm not sure that it will receive it.
And what about the other sort of international relations issues? Clearly, the relationship with the US is not great at the moment. We've got issues, with Taiwan, which seem to be becoming more and more tense. Are we going to be able to see China putting those to one side? And or do you think that other international relations issues will get in the way at COP26 and prevent, you know, agreement on key issues?
I think, you know, the negotiators at COP26 will be focused on the questions at hand. It is all about the optics and the kind of international diplomacy around it. There's talk of Kerry going to China again and Sharma from the UK going to China again in order to try and get some kind of commitment. And part of the success in the run-up to Paris was that there was a huge amount of international diplomacy. And again, China was extremely on board with that because it didn't want to be seen once again as to kind of bear the brunt of all the criticism like it did in Copenhagen. This year, it is much less willing to engage in that kind of conversation ahead of COP26. And so I think the international climate will be challenging, even though on the topics at hand, you know, there is a dedicated team of negotiators that are mandated with certain things that they can do and will want to get done.
And on the assumption that things do go well and that agreements are reached and commitments are made, a final question just about the influence of the regions within China. You know, when these agreements are reached and are looking to be implemented, are there many issues with the kind of regional politics and regional issues that could get in the way of implementation if agreements are reached at COP26?
I mean, implementation in China is always, you know, where the devil is in the detail. But I think, again, part of the reason that China's position might be ambiguous, that a lot of the statements and policy documents that it will issue ahead of time will be relatively vague or flexible, is because it recognizes full well that any commitments will face implementation challenges. And that's, I think, one of the reasons that pledges will not be overly ambitious from the current baseline, right, of peaking before 2030 and net zero by 2060, precisely because China has to leave itself some flexibility for the domestic implementation. It doesn't know how it's going to get to 2060. It does not have a clear roadmap to get there, and it has to leave a lot of options open.
Okay, well, thanks, Mikhail. That's been absolutely fascinating. Your article is in the latest edition of the Forum, which I've mentioned, and can be found on the Oxford Institute website, along with all your other China research, the gas research, and also do have a look out for the new page on the Energy Transition Research Initiative. But with that, thanks again, Mikhail, for your contribution today. Thanks, everyone, for listening. Good health to you all, and goodbye.
Thank you for listening to this podcast from the Oxford Institute for Energy Studies. You can find other podcasts, as well as all our written research, on our website at www.oxfordenergy.org. If you would like more details about our oil, gas, electricity, or China programs, then please contact us at information@oxfordenergy.org.